just pray that we can understand.
I think in light of Jason's sermon this morning on the inevitability of death, maybe we should change the, does anyone have a birthday upcoming, to did anyone have a birthday last week? Seems reasonable to me. And before I start this morning, I'm going to read you a text that I sent to our senior pastor about 3 minutes ago. It has to do with the taping of the microphone to the stand.
That hasn't been fixed yet, has it?
Dear sir, since someone ran off with our microphone stand, and since every Sunday morning I have to tape the microphone to a stand that our microphone will not fit into, I suggest we tap the budget and get our ABC classroom straightened up and more functional. Note also the untidy cords and that populate our classroom. So we'll see what becomes of that.
Although we do note a new piano.
And
next week, we're covering everything.
We'll christen it next Sunday.
Inaugural play next Sunday.
That's because of you, right, Joe?
Yeah. No, it's not. It's a miracle piano.
Oh.
I do not know from whence it came.
Well, the good news is that...
I'm not even really sure it's not the old piano.
The good news is it's a piano and not an accordion. I saw a cartoon during the early days of COVID when everything was, you were having trouble buying paper towels and things at the store. It was a whole showroom full of accordions, and there was a sign that said, "Please, no panic buying, two per customer max." We're here to actually have a lesson, is that right, Jeff?
Well, that's the room.
All right.
It's been a while.
It has been. We'll see if I can remember how to do this. The question I want to start with is this. Have you ever been tempted when reading a novel to skip to the end of the book and see how all the tensions are resolved? I usually resist that temptation because knowing the resolution of every tense moment in a story ruins the suspense. And it's the suspense that makes stories interesting. Well, this morning I'm going to break my own rule. I'm going to skip ahead to the resolution of a very tense story that begins in today's passage in 1682 B.C., a passage that introduces the Joseph narratives, the final section of the book of Genesis. The reason I'm breaking my own rule is because at the beginning of this new section, I want to call your attention to the providence of God that's at work behind the scenes in everything that happens to our new central character, Joseph. To set the context for our opening scripture reading, 39 years have passed since Joseph was sold into slavery by his brothers. It's now 1643 B.C., Joseph is 56 years old. His brothers, of course, are a few years older than that. Jacob has died, and Joseph's brothers are guilt-ridden, and they're, quite frankly, terrified that Joseph will seek revenge against them for their inexcusable act of selling him into slavery many years earlier. So I want you to listen to the interaction between the brothers and Joseph, recorded in Genesis chapter 50. Here's what we read. When Joseph's brothers saw their father was dead, they said, "What if Joseph bears a grudge against us, you think? What if Joseph bears a grudge against us and pays us back in full for the wrong we did to him?" So they sent a message to Joseph saying, "Your father charged us before he died, saying, 'Thus you shall say to Joseph, please forgive the transgression of your brothers and their sin, for they did you wrong.'" Now, we don't know if Jacob actually said that to Joseph's brothers, and we may never know that. But they continue, "So now, on the basis of what our father said, please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father.' Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Then his brothers also came and fell down before him and said, "Behold, we are your servants." But Joseph said to them, "Do not be afraid. Am I not in God's place? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for divine good, in order to bring about this present result, to preserve many people alive." H.C. Leupold begins his commentary on Genesis 37 by saying, "The display of divine providence shines forth here perhaps more than anywhere else in sacred history. God's been preparing his people for what's going to unfold in these latter chapters of Genesis since the day he called Abraham out of Mesopotamia, when God said to him, "Arise and go to a land that I'll show to you." Abraham believed God, and he obeyed God, and afterwards he had two sons, Ishmael and Isaac. And from these two, God chose one, Isaac. And he said to Abraham, "I will establish my covenant through Isaac." Then Isaac had two sons, Esau and Jacob. From these two, God chose one, Jacob. In each case, one son was chosen and the other son was rejected. Then Jacob had 12 sons. And of those sons, one son will play a leading role in the future of the nation. And this special son is named Joseph. But going forward, things are going to be very different. God will not appear to Joseph as he had to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And the covenant blessings will not be limited to one son, but specific aspects of the covenant promises will be realized by the descendants of all of Jacob's sons. The land promise will be given, will result in land allocations being given to all the tribes that descend from Jacob's son, except, of course, for the tribe of Levi. The priestly duties that formerly fell to the patriarchs individually will be performed exclusively by the priests, sons of Levi. And the tribe of Judah will possess the scepter of kingship forever, for it will be through the tribe of Judah that the Messiah comes into the world. These things will be revealed to Israel progressively over time, and there is going to be a delay between the giving of the promises and the fulfilling of the covenant promises. When Abraham left to Mesopotamia, I think he thought the promises were going to be fulfilled as soon as he arrived in Canaan. But over time, he realized it was going to be through his descendants that he would possess the land. Nevertheless, I think for a while he even believed the covenant fulfillment would be near term. It wasn't until Genesis 15, verse 16, that Abraham was told there would be this span of time that would involve oppression and a land not his own. And now Jacob's descendants are standing on the cusp of that oppression. God's about to exercise his providential hand to bring his plan to pass. Israel is going to Egypt. The life of Joseph is a lesson in the doctrine of divine sovereignty. What you should be looking for from this point forward in Genesis is evidence of God's providence working through the affairs of men, both believers and unbelievers, to bring about the formation of the chosen nation promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So what exactly do we mean by providence? Well, providence is God working in human history to bring about what he has foreordained in his sovereignty. It's the way God guides human destiny. For clarity on this, I want to skip over to the book of Daniel for just a moment and read verse 36 from chapter 11. "Then the king will do as he pleases, and he will exalt and magnify himself above every god, and will speak monstrous things against the God of gods, and he will prosper until the indignation is finished." And here's what I want you to hear. "For that which is decreed will be done." Historically, this king is the king of Syria, Antiochus Epiphanes, who captured Jerusalem in 167 BC. But the eschatological reference, the forward-looking reference, is Antichrist. In this passage, we see the interaction of human volition and the divine decree. Whether referring to Antiochus or to Antichrist, this man makes decisions. He chooses to magnify himself above God. And of course, this is blasphemy against both God and his word. But despite this assertion, at the end of the verse, what's important is that phrase, "that which is decreed will be done." This is providence working through the volitional choices of men to bring about the fulfillment of God's decretive will. Now, the will of God must be understood in two distinct ways, and I know I've talked about this before, but since Jason told us we only remember 10% of what we hear and read anyway, it's not going to hurt to repeat this. And this won't be the last time, by the way. I want you to understand how to think about God's will. We start with what we call God's preceptive will. Preceptive from the word referring to precepts. God's preceptive will is his revealed precepts given to men through his revealed word and through the moral law that God has written on our hearts. That is the innate sense of right and wrong that is built into us. God's precepts provide direction for living ethically, that is, living as God would have us live. Now, this is important, so I want you to think about this. God has granted to man the ability, but not the right, to disobey his preceptive will. This is the realm of free agency. Sin is any violation of God's preceptive will. Daniel says of Antichrist, he will do as he pleases. Daniel presents Antichrist as a free agent who makes decisions regarding the preceptive will of God, and remember, he has the freedom to disobey it. Here we see volition operating within the limits set by God's divine decree. That's an important thing to think about. We see volition, the ability to make decisions, operating within the limits set by God's divine decree. Notice the decision Antichrist makes. He will exalt and magnify himself above every god. He acts as a free agent, but his decisions are limited. He is by nature anti-God, and as such, he acts according to that nature, not contrary to it. In other words, free agency relates to God's preceptive will, and it's limited both by the character of the free agent and by the limits set by God's divine decree. Now, in contrast to God's preceptive will is God's decretive will. God's decretive will is that by which God decrees everything that happens. There are no exceptions to God's decretive will. Nothing happens outside the realm of God's decretive will. So I want you to notice what Daniel did. He qualifies free agency by saying he will prosper until. Until is a limiting factor. He will prosper until the indignity is finished, for that which is decreed will be done. Now, here's the key to understanding this. Whereas God has granted to man the ability, but not the right, to defy his preceptive will, God has not given man the ability or the right to defy his decretive will. It's on the basis of this distinction that we read in 2 Peter 3:9, "The Lord is patient toward you, not wishing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance." This is God's preceptive will. But then we go to Ephesians 1:5 and we read, "He predestined us to the adoption of sons through Christ according to the kind intention," and here you can read, "his decretive will." Now, It will serve us well if we can keep these distinctions in mind as we study the events that surround Joseph's life. Joseph is singled out from his brothers as the object of God's choice. And as the subject of God's choice, he is an illustration of divine election. He's to play a specific role in God's decreed plan for Israel. So keep in mind that though Joseph is the prominent character from this point on in the book of Genesis, it is God who's the real central figure as he works providentially through the affairs of men to accomplish the plan he decreed before the foundation of the world. Griffith Thomas, English clergyman and co-founder with Louis Sperry Chafer of Dallas Seminary, in his commentary on Genesis, suggests some additional considerations beyond the theme of providence. He says, without the story of Joseph, a great deal of important information about the formation of the nation of Israel would be missing from the Old Testament. Can you imagine, for example, trying to make sense of Israel's history if Genesis ended with the family history of Esau and then picked up with the Exodus? We wouldn't know how Israel got into Egypt. We wouldn't understand much about the oppression of Israel under the Pharaohs. And the Exodus, the most important event in Israel's history, would seem far less significant. To sum up, we need the story of Joseph to make sense of the Old Testament. There are valuable lessons to be learned from Joseph's life. For example, we're told in our culture all the time that behavior can be explained and thus excused because of some trauma endured by the offender at some point in his life. But I want you to think about Joseph. He's a 17-year-old kid. He's thrown into a pit by his brothers. Then he's sold to a caravan of strangers. He's loaded onto a camel, sold again into slavery in Egypt, a place where he didn't even know how to speak the language. Then because he made the right decision regarding Potiphar's wife, he was thrown into prison where for a period of years he was forgotten. Yet, it's hard to find a flaw in his character other than, well, maybe he was naively arrogant to his brothers. I think we'll see momentarily that that's true. Griffith Thomas also points out that Joseph in many ways prefigures Christ. Joseph, like Christ, suffered for righteousness' sake. He triumphed over evil and thus was exalted to a position of authority in the king's court in Egypt. Beyond this, both Joseph and Christ were objects of envy and hatred by their brothers. Both were betrayed and sold for money. Both were rejected because of unbelief. Yet, it's through this very rejection that God brought about the deliverance of his people. Pascal also believed Joseph prefigured Christ, and just for the sake of time, I'm not going to read you all of his comments, but I did include them as supplementary material in your handout, so you can read those at your leisure. In sum, Joseph's forgiveness of his brothers illustrates Christ's forgiveness of us. So let's turn now to the exegesis of the passage. And we're in Genesis chapter 37. We're going to read the first 11 verses to get started. Now Jacob lived in the land where his father had sojourned, in the land of Canaan. These are the records of the generations of Jacob. Joseph was 17 years of age. He was pasturing the flock with his brothers while he was still a youth, along with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. You remember those are the two maids that were given to Jacob. And it says that Joseph brought back a bad report about these boys to their father. Now, Israel, and the word Israel in verse 3 is Jacob. This is not the nation, this is the man, Jacob. You'll recall his name was changed to Israel. Now, Israel, or Jacob, loved Joseph more than all of his sons because he was the son of his old age. And he made him and I'm reading this as it's translated, a very colored tunic. His brothers saw that their father loved him more than all the brothers, and so they hated him. And they couldn't speak to Joseph on friendly terms. Then Joseph had a dream. When he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, "Please listen to this dream which I've had. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf rose up and also stood erect. And behold, your sheaves gathered around and bowed down to my sheaf." That's how to make friends and influence brothers. Then his brother said to him, "Are you actually going to reign over us? Or are you really going to rule over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Wouldn't you know, he had yet another dream. And he related it to his brothers. And he said, "Lo, I've still had another dream. And behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars were bowing down before me." Note the number 11. He related it to his father and to his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said, "What is this dream that you've had? Shall I and your mother and your brothers actually come to bow ourselves down before you to the ground?" And his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept his saying in mind. Contextually, verse 1 really belongs at the end of chapter 36, not at the beginning of chapter 37, because chapter 37 stands in contrast to chapter 36, that is, in contrast with the family history of Esau. So we're moving now from this non-elect line of Esau to the unfolding of God's plan for Israel, a plan he will accomplish through the elect line of Jacob's family, beginning with Joseph. Joseph was 17 years old. He's working alongside his brothers, sons of Bilhah, that would be Dan and Naphtali, the sons of Zilpah, Gad and Asher, all of whom were young men. At some point, Joseph gave an unsolicited report to his father regarding his brother's work ethics. Apparently, they weren't working very hard, and the report that he gave was unfavorable. And I know it's hard to look back and analyze personalities who lived over 3,500 years ago, but we do know without any question that Jacob was deceptive, right? Well, in contrast to Jacob, Joseph was not deceptive. He wasn't greedy or crafty, but Joseph was naive, and he tended to say things that sounded arrogant, and this report is a good example of that. I don't think Joseph was deliberately arrogant, but he lacked tact when dealing with his family, because it's possible to be so naive not to realize that good news about yourself, or in this case, a less than stellar report about his brothers, might not be well received. Joseph failed to realize his father's favoritism and his good gifts, however well deserved, might rub his brothers the wrong way. Let's face it, no one likes a tattletale. And Joseph looked a lot like a tattletale when he brought this bad report to his father. Now, to make matters worse, earlier in chapter 33, when Jacob was afraid that Esau was going to attack his family, remember when they met over in Transjordan? What Jacob did is he separated his children into groups based on maternal relationships. So he's afraid that his brother is going to attack. And so what does he do? Well, he positioned the groups as follows. He put the maids and their sons, that would be Bilhah and Zilpah, and their sons were placed at the front of the line, subjecting them to the most risk. If Esau decided to attack Jacob's plan, they were the ones who were going to get killed first. And guess what? These are the very boys about whom Joseph gave a bad report. Next in line were Leah and her sons, followed by Rachel and her son Joseph, who was placed at the back of the line in a place of safety, while his brothers were subjected to the most danger. You could argue Joseph was the youngest and therefore the most vulnerable, but that's not how young boys would interpret the situation. They would see this as parental favoritism, a favoritism expressed at the expense of their own safety. And you know what? They never forgot it. Jacob favored Joseph over his other children because Joseph was the son of his old age, And perhaps more importantly, I think, because she was the firstborn of Rachel, who was truly the true love of his life. Jacob didn't hide his favoritism. It was clear for all the brothers to see. In fact, he gave a gift to Joseph. This is what we know. This is what you learn as a child, right? Joseph got a gift from his father that set him apart from his brothers. Jacob gave Joseph this special tunic. Now, this tunic may have indicated that Joseph was going to get the inheritance of the firstborn, even though he wasn't Jacob's eldest son. At the very least, it symbolized Joseph's preeminence over his brothers. And think about those dreams. That's exactly what the dreams did. Now, this tunic is in the Hebrew text is called a kithonet pasim. Kithonet pasim. How's that translated in your Bibles? Anyone? Yeah. It's commonly translated as a coat of many colors, right? I hate to tell you this. And you know what's coming, don't you? That isn't what the Hebrew text says. Although, it's possible there may be some archaeological evidence from Avaris in northern Egypt that his tunic was colorful, but that's another story for another day. Here's what Martin Luther said about this Hebrew phrase, kithonet pasim. Martin Luther, I don't have any idea what those Hebrew words mean. The specific term Luther referred to is the word pas, P-A-S. It's an Aramaic word that means palm of the hand or sole of the foot. It does not mean multicolored. This was a tunic that extended to the wrists and the ankles. It was not the traditional workman's tunic worn by Jacob's other sons. This was the tunic of an aristocrat who was not required to perform manual labor. A workman's tunic was sleeveless, and it came to the knees. Joseph's tunic set him apart from his brothers. Jacob gave his brothers work clothes, and he gave Joseph a three-piece suit. When the brothers perceived their father loved Joseph more than he loved them, they hated him, until finally their animosity became intolerable. We often use the phrase, the last straw, to refer to an event that pushes us beyond our ability to act civilly. I've experienced this particular last straw, and I suspect you have too. I'm going to deviate from my notes a minute. All 4 years I was at Dallas Seminary, I worked at the Bank of Dallas as a drive-in teller. One day, a man from another state pulled up at my window, and I ran three of those pneumatic tube things, right? You know. Pulls up, wants to cash a check on a Vermont bank. And I said, very politely to him, I said, sir, you'll need to go inside the bank and get an officer to approve the check. I can't cash it out here. Now, I have to give you a little bit of background. Bruce Waltke gave us an archaeology test about 15 minutes before this happened. And when he told us about the test the day before, he told us the wrong chapter. And so everyone studied the wrong chapter, and everyone failed the test. So I was not in a good mood when I got to work. And this guy reacted violently, and he got out of his car, and he threw the pneumatic tube at my window, and it splatted on the window. And I lost it. I ran out the back and started chasing this guy. And the guard, who was up ahead of me, said, I'll get him. Now, here's where I'm almost ashamed. Well, I'm not really, but his car was blocked. It's a Friday afternoon. He's blocking traffic. I got in his car, drove it out into the middle of Lemon Avenue, parked it crossways to Lemon Avenue, left it running, and locked the doors. And I went down to the coffee room and sat down at a table with a cup of coffee preparing to be fired. I worked for this nicest lady. I wish I could remember her name and I would give her credit here. But she was my boss, and pretty soon she came down and sat down next to me. And we just sat there for a minute. And I'll never forget this. She said, "So it finally happened, didn't it?" I said, "Yes, ma'am." She said, "I'll tell you what. Take off early, go home. I'll balance your window, and I'll clock you out at 6 o'clock. Now, that's an elaborate definition of a last straw, okay? So now that we all know what a last straw is, we can agree it's not a pretty picture. And all that's happened up to this point has just pushed these brothers. But it gets worse, because in verses 5 through 8 and 9 to 10, we have the record of two dreams Joseph had concerning his family. Now, these dreams are the first of three sets of dreams that we will see in the rest of Genesis and the Joseph narratives. But these are the only two dreams that relate to Joseph that are recorded in Genesis. As with Pharaoh's two dreams, which we'll see in chapter 41, Pharaoh's dreams are said to be one dream. In other words, the two dreams that Pharaoh had really told the same story. And that's the case here. The two dreams that Joseph is going to recount here are two dreams that tell the same story using different symbols. Specifically, these dreams predict Joseph's preeminence, the same message that this tunic he had been given by his father conveyed to his brothers. All this together led Joseph's brothers to hate him so much that they contemplated murder. Now, this doesn't excuse them, but it does help us understand why they hated Joseph so much. First dreams in verses 5 through 8 takes place on the earth in the pasture lands. Joseph expounded his dream with great enthusiasm, which added to his brother's irritation. In the first dream, his brothers were in the field binding sheaves. These are stalks of grain tied together with a cord. As Joseph tells the story, "My sheaves," that is the sheaves representing Joseph, "arose and stood upright. But your sheaves," that is the sheaves representing your ilk, "gathered around and bowed down before mine." The meaning's clear. The brothers had no problem understanding the dream. And as you might expect, they responded with indignation. They replied to Joseph using a verb construction we've seen before in Genesis. They say, "Reigning shall you reign over us, and ruling shall you rule over us." This odd Hebraic representation intensifies the meaning of these verbs. The response also reflects disbelief. "Do you really expect to be our king? Do you really expect to rule over us? Is that what you actually believe? You're nuts." Now, this is important. Do you see the theological meaning of the dream? The clear message of the dream, once again, is the older shall serve the younger. Verses 9 and 10 record the second dream that takes place in the heavens. Joseph apparently didn't learn much from his brother's reaction to the first dream, because he was quick to recount yet a second dream. And the second dream is the first dream retold using different symbols. Joseph explained his second dream with the same great enthusiasm that led to his brother's irritation. But this time, instead of sheaves, it's celestial bodies, the sun, the moon, and 11 stars, just coincidentally. Joseph has my son. Joseph has 11 brothers, right? Sun and the moon are the parents, the father and the mother. And they all bow down not to a sheaf, but to Joseph himself. At this time, Jacob's in the audience. The brothers were incensed by the second dream, and so was Jacob, quite frankly. In fact, Jacob rebuked Joseph. He said, "Shall your mother and I bow down to you?" This scene closes with a very interesting verse. It's verse 11. We see the wisdom of Jacob. The brothers envied him, but the father kept or guarded his saying in his heart. Notice the contrast. The emotional, ego-driven response of the young man is envy. The measured response of Jacob is wisdom. Old age does have its benefits. Jacob had seen this envy in the eyes of Esau. He saw it many years before. And he knew the destruction, envy, and hatred could bring to a family. He also understood the arrogance of Joseph, for he had seen it in himself. Jacob knew God had chosen the younger sibling to rule over the older ones. He had experienced the exact same thing himself, as did his father Isaac. So Jacob guarded Joseph's dream. He may not have liked it, but he didn't discount it. Now there's a practical lesson in these verses. A faithful believer in service to the Lord will find favor. However, faithfulness may engender hatred from the unfaithful, even in a family. The Joseph story began with Joseph as the faithful son. But this part of the story ends with estrangement in the elect family of God, a condition caused by Jacob's favoritism and Joseph's brothers' rebellion against God's decision to exalt Joseph over them. Joseph was destined to play a very significant role in the formation of the nation of Israel. But first, there would be a time of refinement. In life, there are two ways to learn lessons, the easy way and the hard way. And there is value in learning about life the hard way. It isn't the most intelligent way, but it's effective. The Apostle Paul went so far as to say, "Believers who have been justified by faith and who exult in hope also should exult in tribulation." As a hobby, some of you know, I used to teach people to fly airplanes. And one of the courses I taught focused on spin recovery. Now, an aerodynamic spin in an airplane is an out-of-control descent in which the airplane spins around its vertical axis. And unless stopped, the plane and the pilot will end up at the bottom of a smoking hole in the ground. One of the problems with spin recovery is it requires the pilot to do some things that are non-intuitive. In other words, the required control inputs to stop the spin differ from what may seem right to the pilot. Here's another way to say that. There's a way that seems right unto a pilot, but the end thereof is a crash. That's a paraphrase of Proverbs 14:12. Now, it may surprise you to know that the FAA does not require pilot candidates to be trained in spin recovery in order to get a pilot's license. So the next time someone invites you to go flying with them, you might want to ask them, how do you handle spins? There's a great number of pilots fly around today who have only read about spins in a book, but they've never experienced one, and I will tell you from my own experience, there's a big difference. I was concerned that my students wouldn't be able to regain control of a spinning aircraft just from what he or she had read in a book, so I always offered a spin training course as an option. I never had a student turn down the opportunity to learn how to recover successfully from a spin. There's inherent value in learning from experience. In Romans chapter 5, verse 3, Paul points out that tribulation brings about perseverance. And this must be an important principle because we find it throughout Scripture. Jesus himself said, "In the world, you will have tribulation." And then he goes on to say, "But take courage, I've overcome the world." The clearest expression of this principle is in 1 Peter chapter 4. Peter writes, "Do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you which comes for your testing, as if something strange were happening to you. But to the degree that you share the sufferings of Christ, keep on rejoicing, so at the revelation of his glory you may rejoice with exultation." In other words, if Christ's suffering preceded his glorification, don't be surprised if in your own experience suffering precedes blessing. The point is, Joseph is not unlike any believer in any age. There's value in identifying with the sufferings of Christ through personal trials and tribulations. So we shouldn't be surprised that God had in store for Joseph and for Israel times of testing designed to bring Joseph, the nation of Israel, and even the church to maturity. So the Egyptian experience for Israel began with a terrible experience for Joseph, who was trapped in the bottom of a dried up well. Now these events are leading to something that shouldn't surprise anyone. God himself told Abraham the covenant blessings would be preceded by four generations of sojourning in a foreign land. And now that time in Egypt, when God gave that prophecy, if you will, to Abraham, he didn't mention the name of the country. He didn't mention Egypt. He said, just in a land not your own. But we know from further revelation, Egypt's going to play a really big role in Israel's history. And it's the experiences of Joseph that give us this really big hint that this is going to be the case. So let me suggest a metaphor for understanding the role of Egypt in the formation of the nation of Israel. Egypt was the womb from which the nation was born at the Exodus. And to carry this analogy a bit further, Israel's spiritual identity was conceived in the faith of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and it was rooted in the Abrahamic covenant. Then afterwards, the nation was formed under a national covenant at Sinai, making the Mosaic Law essentially the constitution of the new nation. But before the birth of the nation can happen, Israel must go to Egypt. And that begins here with Joseph. Now let's get back to the text, beginning with verse 12. Then his brothers went to pasture their father's flock in Shechem. Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers pasturing the flock in Shechem? Come, and I'll send you to them." And he said to his father, "I will go." Then he said to him, "Go now and see about the welfare of your brothers and the welfare of the flock. Bring word back to me." So he sent him from the valley of Hebron. He came to Shechem. A man found him, and behold, he was wandering in the field. The man asked him, "What are you looking for?" And he said, "I'm looking for my brothers. Please tell me where they are pasturing the flock." The man said, "They've moved from here, for I heard them say, 'Let's go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers, and he found them in Dothan. There are two themes that run parallel through these Joseph narratives: the obedience of Joseph and the hatred of the brothers. So let's consider verses 12 through 14 for a moment. Can you think of any reason Jacob might be concerned about his sons who were shepherding his sheep near Shechem? I can. I can think of a reason. One reason might be because of what happened in chapter 34. Simeon and Levi committed premeditated murder when they killed Shechem and the other men of his village over the Dinah incident. One reason, that's a significant reason. Shechem probably had relatives and family members and friends who still lived in that nearby area, and they might have revenge on their minds. And beyond the murders themselves, Jacob's other sons looted the village, took their flocks, even took the women from the village. Jacob's worried. He said so much in Genesis 34, verse 30. He said, "The inhabitants of the land are going to track me down and destroy me because of what you did to Shechem." This is why Jacob wanted a report regarding his son's safety, particularly in light of the Shechem problem. So it's for this reason that he sent Joseph to bring back a report about his brother's welfare. There are three place names that are mentioned in this section: Hebron, where Jacob was living, Joseph's home; Shechem, near where the massacre occurred; and Dothan, where the brothers were tending the sheep. Geographically, Shechem's about 50 miles north of Hebron, so it's probably a four-day walk to get to Shechem. Dothan was another 15 miles north of Shechem. So when Joseph arrived at Shechem, his brothers weren't there, and there's this unidentified man, we don't know who he was, who directed him north to Dothan. And it appears that the man had full knowledge of which brothers these were and exactly where they were working, and I think we understand why he knew this. The massacre was still fresh in the minds of the region, of the people who lived in the region. So Joseph set out for Dothan, which would be at least another day's walk, and he found his brothers there. Now, everything in this chapter up to this point has been to prepare us for what comes next. Look at verse 18. When they saw him from a distance, and before he came close to them, they plotted against him to put him to death. And they said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer. Now then, come, let us kill him. Throw him into one of the pits, and we'll say a wild animal devoured him. Then let's see what will become of his dreams." But Reuben heard this and rescued him out of their hands and said, "Let us not take his life." And he didn't rescue him physically, but he changed their mind. That's what this means, rescued him out of their hands. Reuben said further to them, "Shed no blood. Throw him into the pit that's in the wilderness, but do not lay your hands on him. Don't hurt him. Put him there that," and he said this, "that he that Reuben, might come back afterwards and rescue him from the hands of his brothers and restore him to the father." So Reuben talks his brothers out of killing him, says throw him in the pit with every intention of coming back later and pulling him out of the pit and sending him home. So it came about when Joseph reached his brothers, they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the very colored tunic that was on him, which we know wasn't. And they took him away, threw him in the pit. The pit was empty without any water in it. This pit is a dried up well. Aren't you glad the Abrahamic covenant doesn't rest on the faithfulness and the ethics of any man, especially these men, but rather on the faithfulness of God himself? I am. There are at least two reasons for the spiritual degeneration of Joseph's brothers. First, they were brought up in a bigamous home. When man tampers with God's model for marriage that's laid out clearly in Genesis, we'll end up with something less than what God designed for us. The second reason for the disharmony we see in Jacob's home is this. At some point, these boys had begun to depend on their ancestry for their relationship with the Lord, and not on their own personal relationship with him. There are two things that should be quite obvious about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. First, none of the three patriarchs was perfect. But two, each of the three had a personal relationship with the Lord. Each one believed the covenant was a covenant of grace bestowed on him as an undeserving recipient. Now, this doesn't seem to be the case with these boys. We've already seen them use the sign of the covenant, circumcision, as an enablement to commit premeditated murder of the Shechemites. And though these boys were externally religious, they lacked something in their area of the personal knowledge and faith of the Lord. And I'm not making any proclamation here about their individual salvation. I don't know. I know something's wrong because there's something diametrically opposed in their actions to the faith that we saw in Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Abraham is the Bible's prime example of a man who lived by faith. Same can't be said for these boys. And one can't help but think of Paul's words in Romans 9:6, "For they are not all Israel who are descended from Israel." Now let's consider the events that occurred when Joseph arrived at the camp. It says they saw him from afar. Apparently, he wasn't hard to identify. My maternal grandfather told me a story when I was a boy that I still remember. His family moved from Tennessee to a farm out by Lubbock, Texas. And he lived there until he joined the Army at the beginning of World War I. And he didn't return to Lubbock until he was in his mid-40s, so a number of years had passed since he left Lubbock. Apparently, he arrived there by bus, and he walked several miles to the area where he had lived over 25 years earlier. As he was approaching the vicinity of the homestead, he saw a man running toward him from a great distance away. Turns out it was his best friend from childhood. And my granddad had had no communication with this man for over 25 years. And he asked the man, he said, "How did you know to run and meet me?" His answer was, "Because no one else walks exactly like Archie DeLewis Miller." As with my grandfather, the brothers would have known Joseph's gait. Then, of course, there was that tunic that made him easy to see and identify from a distance. So they recognized him even before he came within earshot. Still far enough away, he could not hear their conversation. And then we read, they conspired against him to slay him. Now, this was not an idle threat. When these boys threatened to kill someone, they meant it. Think about the massacre of Shechem. These are the same guys. There's no doubt that they were capable of killing Joseph. And the mere sight of him was sufficient to engender in them a hatred so great that even murder seemed to be reasonable. There are several different Hebrew words that can be translated to kill. It's a broad range of semantic terms. And it's telling that the word that's used here is the very same word used in Genesis 4:8 of Cain's murder of his brother, Abel. As Joseph approached them, they referred to him with a condescending phrase. They said, "Here comes the Lord of the dreams." So it's pretty clear what pushed them over the line with Joseph. It was those dreams. We know this because the brothers say in verse 20, "Let's see what becomes of his dreams after we've killed him." We know this is terrible. This is a horrible situation to occur in this family. The plan came together quite quickly without much forethought. Let's kill him, throw him in a hole, and say an animal killed him. What a plan. Reuben was not the instigator of this plan, but he overheard his brothers formulating the plan. And to his credit, Reuben planned to rescue Joseph later that night. So Reuben pushed back against his brother, saying, "Let's not smite his soul." That's a literal translation. "Let's not kill him. Shed no blood." Maybe Reuben knew the story of Cain and Abel. Perhaps he just felt as the firstborn, he would be the one held responsible by his father for the loss of his favorite son. So when Joseph arrived at the camp, they didn't kill him, but they stripped him of his tunic. They cast him in this man-made cistern, this empty well, and they left him there. Verse 25. Then they sat down to eat. Then they sat down to eat a meal, and as they raised their eyes and looked, behold, a caravan of Ishmaelites was coming from Gilead, their camels bearing aromatic gum and balm and myrrh, on their way to bring them down to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is there for us to kill our brother, cover up his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh." And his brothers listened to him, and then the Midianite traders passed by, so they pulled him up, lifted Joseph out of the pit, sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. Thus they brought Joseph into Egypt. 20 shekels of silver was the price of a slave in those days. It was later raised to 30. They sat down to eat bread. "How can you plot the death of your brother? Throw him in a pit and then sit down and have a meal." Yet the brothers appear to be unaffected by their actions toward Joseph. Later in Genesis 42, when the brothers are in Egypt and in trouble with Joseph, a man who now has authority over them, a man whom they do not recognize as their brother, when it is they who are in the pit, at least metaphorically, they began contemplating their actions those many years ago when they treated Joseph with rank callousness. In Genesis 42:21, we read, "Truly, we're guilty concerning our brother, because we saw the distress of his soul when he pleaded with us, And yet we didn't listen. So his distress has now come upon us. In other words, Joseph's brothers concluded their current distress in Egypt was the execution of divine justice against them for what they had done previously in Dothan. And you know what? Maybe they're right. One can't help but wonder to what degree their prior actions had plagued their minds through the years. Genesis 37 doesn't record Joseph's fear or his distress, and I dare say stark terror. Yet while Joseph begged for his life, his brothers enjoyed a meal while Joseph was hungry and scared in the bottom of a pit. Simeon must have been the main propagator of this crime, because years later in Egypt, it'll be Simeon whom Joseph will bind before the face of his brothers. You can decide for yourself, but I would wager it was Simeon who bound Joseph that afternoon in Dothan. And there may be a bit of irony when Joseph served meals to his brothers in Egypt, because these are the same brothers who withheld food from him in Dothan. Dothan was located on a caravan route between Gilead to the east and Egypt. And while they ate, a caravan of Ishmaelites, also known, by the way, as Midianites, passed by. These two groups, Ishmaelites and Midianites, both descended from Abram. And in Judges 8:24, that verse identifies these two groups as one and the same. So there's not a contradiction here in the text. This all came down to hatred and greed. Judah saw here a double opportunity. They could spare their brother's life, though they hated him, and they could make some money at the same time. So they sold their brother to the Midianites. This caravan would have passed through Dothan, or from Dothan, south through Hebron, Joseph's home, and then on to the southwest to Egypt. It's very possible Joseph could see his own home from the camel on which he was riding when they passed through Hebron, an experience that would have heightened his despair because there was nothing he could do about his situation. Let's finish the chapter, verse 29. Now Reuben returned to the pit. Behold, Joseph was not in the pit. So he tore his garments. He returned to his brothers and said, "The boy is not here. As for me, where am I to go?" So they took Joseph's tunic and slaughtered a male goat, dipped the tunic in blood, and they sent the very colored tunic and brought it to their father. And they said, "We found this. Please examine it and see whether your son's tunic, if this is your son's tunic or not." You know, they didn't have to do that. They could have just said, "We never saw him." Jacob examined it, and he said, "It's my son's tunic. A wild beast must have devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces." So Jacob tore his clothes, and he put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days. Then all his sons and his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, "Surely I will go down to Sheol, to the grave, in mourning for my son." Because his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, Pharaoh's officer, the captain of the bodyguard. So Reuben was not pleasant when this sale to the Midianites took place, because when he returned, he's in shock that Joseph isn't in the pit. Verses 31 through 35 record the cover-up, which is based on deception, this ever-present evil trait that followed Jacob from Canaan to Haran, and now back to Canaan. The tunic itself became a telegram of doom, if you will, announcing Joseph's demise. It's dipped in goat's blood, sent to Jacob as a stark announcement of the tragedy he would assume befell his son. This can't help but cause us to question the quality of the brothers' relationship with their father. They make no effort to soften the blow. In fact, the message itself in the form of this tunic, now covered in blood, communicates to the reader a deep level of callousness in their relationship with Jacob. The scene ends with Jacob officially in mourning. He tore his clothes, as Middle Easterners sometimes do, an act eerily symbolic of the alleged fate of his son. The Midianites sold Joseph in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard. Now, this is important. This is important because from this verse, we know Joseph will not disappear over the horizon, never to be seen or heard from again. Rather, he was sold to an important man named Potiphar, whose name in Egyptian is Potipherah, which means he whom Ra has given, the sun god Ra. There's also a clue here that may provide us with some back. Hello. There's a clue here that may give us some background for an event that we'll study in Genesis chapter 39. And I say may provide because I'm not certain about this. In Genesis 39, Potiphar is said to be a Sarice. The word Sarice came to mean officer or official, which is how it's translated in our English versions. And that very well may be its the totality of its meaning here. But if you look at the Septuagint taps into an older meaning of the word Sarice derived from Akkadian, because the Septuagint translation reads Potiphar was a eunuch of Pharaoh. In the world of Semitic languages, the word Sarice originally meant eunuch. We know that. And if this is true, and if that's the correct meaning here, and I say here because words change their meaning over time and how they're used, but if that's how this is intended, Potiphar was a eunuch, which may prove to provide insight regarding the conduct of his wife toward Joseph. We don't know. There's, of course, an obvious question. Why would a eunuch be married?
Exactly.
Believe it or not, many were, and we know this. Sometimes it was for social or for political reasons. So as counterintuitive as it may sound, it's a distinct possibility Potiphar was a eunuch. And we'll leave it there as a possibility. More important than this, the chapter ends with several bits of information that cause us to recall the role of providence. The role that providence plays throughout the life of Joseph. And I've included some of that information in your handout because I knew we would be late today. And you can read it at your leisure. So we're now officially into the Joseph narratives. And I think you'll find this last section of Genesis to be the most interesting part of the entire book. La fin. Jeff, close us in prayer.
All right. Father, again, we are grateful that you always accomplish. Father, we're great.